Today on Maine Calling, stroke. How to recognize one and what to do. What do Luke Perry, Charles Dickens, Cary Grant, Debbie Reynolds, and Margaret Thatcher have in common? Unfortunately, the answer is not fun. What they have in common is that they all died from a stroke. Strokes are common. In fact, they are the second leading cause of death worldwide. And public health officials are alarmed by recent statistics showing that stroke is on the rise among younger adults. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, leading Maine doctors guide us through what we all need to know about stroke, how to recognize the signs of stroke, how much time we have to respond, how to reduce our chances of having a stroke, and what to understand about friends and colleagues who have had a stroke. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and Quarry Cottages at Highland Green, committed to providing low-maintenance living and dedicated to creating a community where residents are free to pursue their passions, and Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping Northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com. And North Yarmouth Academy, a 2025 AP Platinum School recognized by College Board, inviting families to tour campus, shadow a student, and explore its new dormitory.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Chances are, unfortunately, that you or someone you know will have a stroke. Strokes are a leading cause of death, and even more discouraging, they have become more common among young adults. There are ways to try to prevent strokes and also to recognize stroke symptoms and act quickly. That's our conversation for the hour. Joining me, Dr. Jane Morris, who's a neurohospitalist and stroke specialist with Maine Health, and Dr. Robert Ecker, neurological surgery provider with Maine Health. We invite you to share your comments and questions. Do you want to know what your risk is of having a stroke? How would you know? And what would you do if you notice symptoms in yourself or someone else? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. Welcome back to both of you. Dr. Morris, I'll start with you. I just said that stroke is the second leading cause of death in the world and that they're quite common. How common? Can you characterize what you are seeing?
Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you for having us on again. We really appreciate this opportunity to talk to the public about stroke. So one of the easy statistics to kind of remember is that every 40 seconds, somebody in the United States has a stroke. So it's that common. It's about 800,000 strokes per year.
Wow. Dr. Ecker, what is happening to the brain and body when a stroke occurs?
When a stroke occurs, broadly speaking, two different kinds of stroke when we speak about stroke. The first kind we think about, that most people think about, is when a clot goes to a blood vessel in the brain and blocks off blood flow to that area. So sometimes it can block off blood flow to a small area of the brain where someone has a little bit of numbness or tingling, say in a hand. Or sometimes it's a major blood vessel in the brain where someone can lose their ability to talk or lose motor function on half their body. That area goes on progressively to die if the clot is not removed or broken up.
Dr. Morris, a recent spate of reporting shows an increase in stroke among young people, and not just young people sort of under the age of 64, but people under the age of 35. What's going on? Why is this happening?
Well, one important thing to know is that strokes can occur at any age. And even in very healthy people for various reasons. The most common age group is over 65. It's about 3/4 of strokes. But the increase in younger patients, primarily that's been driven by lifestyle factors. So things like lack of exercise, lack of a healthy diet, substance use like tobacco, and the opiate use disorder has led to, as we know, an epidemic of patients who can come in with strokes due to infections in their heart valves, which is can be devastating. And then there are other causes of stroke that are overall rare, but more common in young patients. Those specifically would be something called a dissection, where you get a tear in the wall of the vessel going to your brain. And that can be sometimes triggered by trauma, can also be spontaneous. And then another subtype that is relatively common in the younger population is something called a patent foramen ovale, which is a sort of sometimes commonly called a quote hole in the heart, but it's a an actual something that is present in about a quarter of people, but in a subset can result in clot forming in the heart and going up to the brain.
And these recent statistics, are they that there actually is an increase in stroke in young people, or is it more, is it just that it's more often diagnosed now? Because that happens with many things, that there's some question about whether or not something is really on the rise or whether people are just accurately diagnosing it more often.
I think that this is probably a case where it is more, it is actually happening more. There is a rise in stroke in the young patients. Strokes tend to be, for the most part, noticeable, disabling, and do provoke patients to seek out help for diagnosis.
One of the celebrities who recently had a stroke at a young age was the model and influencer Hailey Bieber. She was 25. And Dr. Ecker, she told the media afterwards, she's become a spokesperson for stroke prevention, but she said that she has migraines and was on birth control. In retrospect, shouldn't have, that's a bad combination. And I'm wondering, do you find that people who already have migraines are at higher risk of stroke and need to be careful about medications?
It's actually a better question for Jane in the context of natural history. So I'm going to defer to Jane on that question.
Yeah, go ahead, Jane.
Sure. Yeah. So specifically for the subtype of migraines with aura, and an aura can be some symptom that occurs before the migraine. And it can be sometimes flashing lights or visual changes. It can sometimes be things like numbness on part of the body. It can actually mimic a stroke. And for that subset of people with migraine with aura, they do have a slight increased risk of stroke, but on the whole, it's relatively small. It's just a few percentage points per 100,000 people.
Dr. Ecker, I know that much of what you do is to save a life when somebody's had a stroke. Going in and getting that clot before it does much damage. Tell me where we are in medicine. How dramatic can the outcome be, even when somebody's had what would be considered a serious stroke?
That's a better question for me. That remains an extraordinary thing to me. I have to say, I trained with some people in the early 2000s who helped define a lot of this work, and that work, unlike the work at Maine Medical Center, where most strokes who come in are patients anesthesia will actually put under a general anesthetic, we did a lot of that work with conscious sedation. So in the early 2000s, when we started defining how to do this work, I'd actually have many, many patients who came in and they couldn't move half their body or they couldn't speak. And literally by the time we took the clot out, they could actually speak and move as they were moving over to the gurney. So really, there is nothing, I think, more extraordinary actually in surgery or interventional medicine than that. As far as the revolution, the tools for doing this work have gotten better and better every year. The catheters for getting to the brain, the tools we use for pulling out the clot or sucking out the clot are better. A series of papers came out in 2015 that showed that really prior to 2015, with just the IV medication alone, under 30% of patients were independent at 90 days. And now with the techniques we use, up to 70% of patients are independent at 90 days. And the amount of sheer disability and death that has prevented in this country, in Europe, in Asia, where these techniques are available, and the billions of dollars saved is really a once in a generation improvement in stroke care that we're going to incrementally improve on. I'm sure as the tools get better, we're going to define them better. But it is an extraordinary thing that has been an amazing part of my career to have been part of from the start.
Calling in now is Dr. Avirag Goswami, who's a vascular neurologist and director of stroke care at Northern Light Eastern Maine Medical Center. Dr. Goswami, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
A great follow-up to what Dr. Ecker is describing is the importance of speed when somebody shows symptoms of a stroke. I know that stroke symptoms can come on quickly and that acting quickly is critical. Explain how quickly and why that's so important.
Yeah, so stroke, acute ischemic stroke, is very time sensitive. And it's very, very important for patients and their family members around that to recognize the symptoms of stroke. And since there is a ischemic stroke happens because of the blockage of the blood vessels, there is a cut off interruption of the blood supply to the part of the brain and tissue, and that tissue starts to die off if not taken care of in timely manner. So time is the essence here. So patient, it's important to recognize the symptoms timely, and once recognized, calling 911 timely manner, so you could be brought to the hospital in a timely manner, and we can initiate the stroke protocol, acute ischemic stroke therapies we can offer in a timely manner. Earlier the treatment, better is the outcome. And saying that, it's important to know the acronym for the patient and the family members to recognize the symptoms, which we go by BEFAST, B-E-F-A-S-T, where B is balance issues. When someone is noticing they are having difficulty walking, swinging one side or the other, E is for eyes, meaning vision, when someone notices any changes in their vision, visual field defect. And F is for the face, when they notice that their face is drooping one side or the other, hard time closing the eyes. And A is arm or leg, when they feel they lost their strength in arm or the limb, or feeling numbness or tingling. And S is for speech, when they have trouble articulating or coming up with the words or difficulty comprehending. So all these symptoms, if any of these symptoms is someone recognizes, then they need to call 911T, timely manner. So earlier is, you come to the hospital, chances of the better outcome is higher.
Yeah, Dr. Goswami, I wanted to ask you, because even though every doctor that we're talking to today treats people who live in rural Maine, it is especially relevant where you are, that you have people who are coming to Eastern Maine Medical Center who live in a very rural area. Is there anything that can happen in the ambulance or in the life flight helicopter that can be helpful before that patient gets to you?
Yeah, so no, the thing is that once you recognize the symptoms and you call 911 and the paramedics arrive to your doorstep, management of the stroke essentially starts from that point on. That includes taking initial vitals, making sure patient is hemodynamically stable, and also gathering information which are very pertinent for us to determine what stroke therapy will patient qualify for, and initial resuscitation and triaging the patients. That is very important to route or reroute the patient to the appropriate centers on the site. Speaking of the transportation mode on route, whether it's a helicopter or it's an ambulance, so currently in Maine, we just generally try to stabilize the patient. However, there is one thing called mobile stroke unit, which apparently we don't have yet here in the Maine, but that is something, it's near future. We are hoping that if we have that available, that can even further help managing stroke even better, because they have the CAT scan available, the imaging modalities available in the unit, in the ambulance, and that can give us the information even early on as the patient arrives to the hospital. And that way we can promptly manage the stroke and shorten the time. That will definitely will help with the outcomes.
Well, Dr. Goswami, thank you for calling in and joining the conversation. Dr. Avirag Goswami is Director of Stroke Care at Northern Light Eastern Maine Medical Center. Dr. Ecker, I want to follow up on that and talk about, I've always heard about the golden hour. Is it really just an hour?
No, well, yes and no. As our colleague at Eastern Maine just said, the timing matters. So the sooner you get to the hospital, both for IV therapy, to break up the clot, or what I do with thrombectomy, the better patients do. We know that. The extraordinary thing, though, is we are now extending the time windows based on advanced imaging, where we're intervening on patients at 24 hours out. We even have published a case on 36 hours out, where if the amount of brain that has not died is relatively small compared to the area still at risk, we can intervene on patients hours after their intervention. Just the number of those patients as time goes on gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
So don't make assumptions. If you, for example, find someone, go to someone's house and find them in a bad condition, don't assume it's too late. Always call 911.
100%. 100%.
Yeah. I want to circle back, Dr. Morris, Jane, to something we were talking about before. I had brought up Hailey Bieber and that she had migraines and was on birth control. We talked about migraines, but you want to talk about so many people on some form of birth control. So, is there an increased risk of stroke if one is using birth control?
Yes, thanks. So that is a really big question we often get from young women. And there is a slight, again, a few percentages increase in risk of stroke with birth control. What's very important to also know, though, is there's actually an increased risk of stroke in pregnancy, and the risk of stroke in pregnancy is higher than it is from taking birth control. And in patients with these very common things, it's often not just one factor that increases your risk of stroke. It's birth control plus, say, smoking and a poor diet and lack of exercise. So it's often a confluence of risk factors. So it's often we talk about everything you can do to reduce your risk of stroke. Birth control may be part of it. And there are, it's specifically estrogen-containing birth control. So there are non-estrogen birth control options. And so it may be that in an individual, it may not be the right choice, but collectively, most people can be on birth control quite safely.
What strikes me about her case is that I think a lot of people may have a set of assumptions about who is at risk, but she obviously, she's a fashion model. She's not overweight. She's not, I don't believe, was a smoker. And I guess the point is someone can't pat oneself on the back for a healthy lifestyle and assume that they are not at risk, right?
That's right. So the specific categories I mentioned, the dissection and the PFO or patent foramina ovale, are two conditions where healthy people can have strokes with no other risk factors.
Well, we are talking about stroke on Maine Calling. What are your questions for our doctors? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning about the risk of stroke, what happens when you have one, ways to spot symptoms, and what treatments are available. My guests, both with Maine Health, Dr. Rob Ecker is a neurosurgeon, and Dr. Jane Morris is a neurologist and stroke specialist. You can join the conversation. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. I'll start with an email from Maggie. Before a person suffers a stroke, are there visible signs or physical ones you can recognize to prevent a stroke? Also, Jill Biden yesterday stated she believed Joe was having a stroke while debating Trump. If so, did no one see this and escort Biden off the podium? And I'll start with the second question first, very much in the news. I'm sure you all both saw that news. What did you think, Jane, when you saw that Jill Biden was worried that her husband was having a stroke when he was on live national television in a televised debate?
I would say I saw the debate. That was the more concerning. I'm not Joe Biden's doctor. I'm not going to opine on what happened to Joe Biden's health. He definitely had a lapse, and whether that lapse was a stroke or some other process, I could not say without knowing more information about his health.
Dr. Ecker, same reaction?
I think that's likely the best reaction. I was watching the debate.
You watched the debate and you didn't think, oh no, that guy needs to get to a hospital?
You know, at some level of sophistication, where Jane and I taking care of so many patients who have, we sort of will talk about a spell before we call it a stroke and go through their hit. There are a whole bunch of ways that a human brain can malfunction that aren't stroke. So I think it's tough to for us to really opine on that without being his physician and having the full scope of things we would need to answer that question.
Okay. So maybe safe to say, if you were his wife, you would be worried too, but you're not going to diagnose him. Jane?
I would say that what's also true is that there's a lot of things that look like a stroke that are not a stroke, and you can't discern that without being seen by a physician in a hospital with some diagnostic testing.
And how about the first part of Maggie's question, that before a person suffers a stroke, are there visible signs or physical ones that you can recognize to prevent one?
So I'm going to take that in two parts. The first one is preventing stroke, because that's something I'm very passionate about. And one resource I direct people to is the American Heart Association's Life Essential Eights. It has to do with diet, exercise, stopping smoking, getting good sleep, and then monitoring to make sure you have a normal weight, normal blood pressure, normal blood glucose, blood sugar, and normal cholesterol. And if you do those things, you can reduce your risk of stroke by about 80%. So that's something that people need to, you know, take charge of in terms of their own health. If you're concerned about stroke, there's eight things you can do to, you know, decrease your risk of stroke. In terms of, are there warning signs? Unfortunately, most of the time there are not. About 15% of people will have a TIA, sometimes called a mini stroke. TIA stands for transient ischemic attack. It's when there is a blockage of a blood vessel to the brain that spontaneously dissolves. The body does that itself and then restores blood flow on its own, and then the symptoms resolve. Those symptoms can last minutes to up to maybe 2 hours in the typical patient. And those symptoms are a warning sign for stroke. So they look just like a stroke. They do resolve on their own, but it is very important that people don't wait to see if their symptoms resolve. As Dr. Goswami said, it is really important that you get assessed, even if the symptoms have resolved, because a TIA could be a warning for a stroke. And there may be things we can do to reduce your risk of having a stroke after that.
We'll go to Rosalie calling from Bristol. Hi, Rosalie. Go ahead.
So my question is, I live in a rural area of Bristol, and the hospital is in Damascata. So would it be better for someone in my home to put me in the car and take me immediately to the hospital, to the emergency room, rather than wait for an ambulance to come all the way from Damascata, then go back to, you know, come back to come to Bristol and then go all the way back to the hospital?
Rosalie, I think you have a very important question, because so many people in Maine live in a place, especially a place where there may be a volunteer ambulance driver. Dr. Ecker, if someone believes they're having a stroke, is it better to get someone, a neighbor, just to put them in the car and get them to the hospital than to call an ambulance?
I think it's a really complicated question in our community. We have patients actually who have to be brought to a place an ambulance can actually get to them in some of our communities. Never mind the question that she's asking about actually driving. I would say in the ideal world, we'd still get the ambulance there. There are things about starting IV fluids, getting some blood pressure, understanding, you know, how to lower the blood pressure if it's extraordinarily high, like we see in some of our patients. So I think the ambulance is ideally the best choice. But in some of our communities where you are so rural that you actually have to bring a patient to a point of entry for the ambulance to get there, I think this can be a complicated space where you still want to try and move quickly and safely with the patient.
Ahead, Jane.
One of the other things the ambulance does that's extremely important for us is they tell us they're coming with a potential stroke patient. We actually will mobilize our entire stroke team to be ready to meet the patient when they arrive. And when a patient comes in with a private owned vehicle, they have to go through a different triage process. They're met by a greeter. They have to be triaged by a nurse. There are often delays in care once they get to the hospital if they don't come in by ambulance.
Jane, would it be possible, though, Rosalie, I hope you never have a stroke, but if she were to have a neighbor call in, and on the way in, the neighbor were to call the hospital or call 911 and say, I believe my neighbor has had a stroke, I'm bringing her into the hospital right now, we'll be there in 10 minutes. Is that helpful?
I can't say that I've faced that specific situation, and I'm not sure how 911 would, or the emergency room operator would handle that call. And if that would result in the same outcome, because we have a sort of a process in place that we have a patient assessed by an ambulance crew. They're medically trained versus a neighbor who's saying they think their loved one has a stroke. As I mentioned earlier, there are many things that can look like a stroke that are not a stroke. And there may be things like a very common one is low blood sugar that can be treated by a paramedic or an EMT right away and help your symptoms resolve. And they can find out that it's not actually a stroke.
All right. Well, Rosalie, thank you for calling with that question. We'll go to Mary, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mary. Go ahead. Mary, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My question is, if you have high cholesterol, is a calcium scoring test of any benefit in lowering your cholesterol with respect to stroke?
Do either of you have an opinion about a calcium scoring exam?
The calcium score is for heart disease. So that's a good distinction that we should make. Heart attacks and strokes are often confused. Heart attacks are a similar process where you get blockage of blood vessels, but it's to the heart versus the stroke where it's block of blood vessels to the brain. So the calcium score is specific to coronary artery disease, the vessels in the heart. We do not have a calcium scoring for stroke.
All right.
Question of high cholesterol, though, yes, high cholesterol is a risk factor for stroke, and lowering cholesterol will reduce your risk factor for both stroke and heart attacks.
On the line with us now is Tom Watson. He's a real estate entrepreneur and founder of Reveler Development. He is a multiple stroke survivor, and he's written a memoir that is called Your Turn. Thanks for calling in, Tom.
You're welcome, Jennifer.
Your memoir describes how you renovated apartment buildings in Maine over the decades, something you worked very hard at and built into a successful business. But in the book, you also described how your life changed when you had a stroke, actually multiple strokes. Tell us what you went through. What was it like? And did you know that that was what was happening?
No, I had no idea that was happening. We believed my mother had suffered from vertigo. So I was having, we realized later after the stroke that I'd had a number of PIAs over a decade. I thought it was vertigo because I've always had an inner ear issue. So that was a warning sign that I just misdiagnosed. Another very clear warning sign was I would go to my primary care physician. And so my stroke was in December 21, but probably since 2016, he was saying, look, Tom, you have high blood pressure and you need to take high blood pressure medicine. And I was thinking, well, I'll just keep running. I was like a double, I read 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 miles a day. And I also misdiagnosed that because while it helped reduce or eliminate my anxiety, it did not help my blood pressure. It kept me healthy, but it did not reduce my blood pressure. And so I did not take the blood pressure medicine that my doctor implored me to take for probably 4 years. And I think, so here we are now in December 21. I go to Maine Med with the EMTs took me. I had what turned out to be a dissection in my left vertebral artery. This is on a Monday. And they, gave me thinners, checked me out, and sent me home. And the next day, Tuesday, I was sitting on the couch, and it just knocked me out. And I remember raising my finger and looking at my wife saying, I'm done. And the EMTs had been there the day before, so they knew. My wife, Judy, who arguably saved my life, called the EMTs immediately. They had been there the day before. They rushed me to the hospital, and the brilliant surgeon, Matt Sanborn, I was out like a light. In fact, I was out for 4 days. But this surgeon, Matt Sanborn, went in with with the technology that the doctor was referring to and was able to perform emergency vascular brain surgery. And he just whipped me through the ER room right into the OR. And Matt went to work with his group and got the clots and saved my life. And at some point, I don't know what it was, a day or two later, the doctors would know. They checked to see if my fingers and toes work, and they did. So it's, you know, what is it, 4.5 years later, the first 2 years were, you know, it was a lot of physical therapy, speech pathology therapy, occupational therapy. I got better. Finally, it took a lot of work.
Tom, hang on. I want to turn to Dr. Morris and ask her about one thing you said, Tom, how your doctor was imploring you to take blood pressure medication, but instead you just ran more. And Jane, I think that, and I talk about this with my friends, I think there are so many of us that think we really don't want to take medication. We really want to do something else. We can eat healthier. We can run more. We can do something. And I'm wondering if you come up against this and how you sort of fight this cultural norm of, anything but taking medication.
Thank you so much for asking that question. And thank you, Tom, for sharing your story. Absolutely, high blood pressure is the number one risk factor for stroke. If there's one thing that we could do better in this country is if we got everyone's blood pressure under control, we would have a major reduction in not just stroke, but also heart disease and also dementia, which a lot of people are afraid of and don't realize that these same risk factors predispose you to dementia. So yes, there are people who can control their blood pressure through weight and diet, but there's a significant proportion who have to take blood pressure medication to get your blood pressure in the normal range. And if I could get any message out there today, it would be check your blood pressure regularly and make sure it's in the normal range. And if it's not, you got to see your doctor and get something done about it.
Dr. Ecker.
You know, thank you so much for sharing that story. I have to say, if we give some perspective to this, Dr. Morris and I started at Maine Health around the same time. So about 2010, we did zero stroke interventions like we're talking about for Tom in 2009. Since now we do a little over 200 a year. And if you look sort of bringing together some of the commentaries we've been making here, in Maine each year, there are between 3,000 and 4,000 new strokes a year. Of that group, about 10 to 15%, maybe slightly higher, are amenable to these new therapies with stents or removing the clot. So that means that we should be seeing, instead of around the 200 a year, we're doing somewhere between 3 and 400. So that's still speaking to people who are getting to the hospital too late for us to be able to help them. So really emphasizing on these major strokes, where patients will go on to have significant disability or die, we're probably still missing somewhere around 100 to 200 of them a year. So getting patients to the hospital quickly and getting them transported to appropriate care is still critically important.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing your story. You said this was 4.5 years ago. How are you doing now? And what do you want others to know about you and other stroke survivors?
I don't think you would know I had a stroke. Occasionally I walk into a door or something, but you would not know that I have a stroke. So my wife, Judy, was that sort of one true believer, and she got me so much better and went to all my appointments and set up a gym in the basement and had me do all these things. And so I'm much better. I think, as the doctors are saying, I would say it is so important to check your blood pressure regularly. Now, a lot of us have that annual physical and we go to that. So we're checking our blood pressure once a year. That is not enough. I think you have to do it quarterly, if not monthly. And there's plenty of good machines you can get at the pharmacy and you can do it at home and you can check. And because once a year is just not enough. And then I would say if your doctor is suggesting to you that you take medicine, you do it. Now you can talk with your doctor and you can experiment and say, well, I'll take a lower dose and see if that improves your blood pressure. And so you would check it regularly and say, well, it is or it isn't. So you would up that dose. And I hope I answered your question. I'm sure I did.
Yeah. Well, and Tom, the very beginning of what you said was cut off a little bit. And I'm wondering, you said that if someone were to meet you, they wouldn't know that you'd had a stroke, but you don't feel completely the same, right? Your life is not the same as it was before.
Oh, right. No one would know. But yes, there are. I call them diminishments. I'm not sure. I mean, for example, I have dizziness and nausea pretty much every day. And you know, I have like the use of my pinky finger and ring finger on my left hand. You know, I struggle to tie my shoes, things like that. But I, you know, I saw this, I mean, and I had PTSD. I mean, immediately, you know, for the first 2 or 3 weeks, I feared a recurrence. But ultimately, I saw it as not post-traumatic stress, but really as an opportunity, like post-traumatic growth, as an opportunity to get better. And by better, I mean like a better listener, you know, someone who watched more. And so to me, it was an opportunity to get better. I know that sounds a bit ironic, but that's what it was.
Well, I really appreciate you calling in, Tom, and congratulations on your book. Tom Watson is a stroke survivor, a developer, and his new book is Your Turn. We're going to take another quick break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're talking about stroke. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We have two leading stroke specialists with us, Dr. Rob Ecker and Dr. Jane Morris. I'm going to go to an email here from Philip. He writes, I understand the potential for strokes happening in healthy people who experience physical trauma, but why or how would an otherwise healthy person have a stroke spontaneously? Philip, thanks for that question. And Jane, there's someone very close to me who fits into this category. Jane, are you there?
Yes. Can you said someone who's close to you who fits into that category?
Yeah. Somebody who had a stroke, but had not had some sort of trauma. Did you call it a dissection?
Yes. So I did mention that. So dissection is one of the reasons that can happen spontaneously. About half are spontaneous, half are from a trauma. The spontaneous, we don't really know why it happens. It may be something genetic. It may be something environmental. There's a tear in the inner lining of the vessel of the wall, and that is a not uncommon cause of stroke in young patients. And the other one, the patent foramina valley, where there's something that we're all born with in the heart, a conduit between the two chambers of the heart that does not close and can cause either a turbulent flow within the heart or a clot that formed elsewhere in the body could travel across it and go up into the brain. Those are the most common ones. There are other rare causes of stroke. There's actually dozens and dozens of causes of stroke. So it gets into quite a long list when you get to the much more rare causes in stroke in the young.
Go ahead, Rob.
The dissections that Jane has spoken to, these tears in the vertebral or the carotid arteries, up to 20% of patients can actually present with TIA or stroke with those. So it's a relatively common thing. I would say on call during the course of any week, I get called about someone with a tear in the vertebral of the carotids. Most of them don't present with stroke, but not a small, you know, 20% is a reasonable percentage for something that's not uncommon in the population.
That's scary.
For sure, it's scary.
An email here from Lee. One of the things I often hear from survivors is, quote, I knew something was wrong, so I laid down to see if it would pass. Mainers think we are so tough, and sometimes it delays getting help. Also, for survivors, Maine's brain helpline is 1-800-444-6443. That number will connect survivors and caregivers with resources and advice from trained people here in Maine. Dr. Ecker, what about the first part of Lee's email, where people just say, I knew something was wrong, so I laid down. I saw you kind of grimace when I read that. You've heard that.
Jane and I hear that all the time. I mean, it's a very common thing. And, you know, in our Maine community, there's a certain New England stoicism that that does prevent where I took care of a fella. I did actually 4 acute strokes the day before Memorial Day, last Sunday. So did 4, did 1 early Monday morning. So busy weekend for doing acute stroke care. One of the patients was a person who had been like shaking out their hand for 3 days beforehand and thinking that it would go away and then presented with a fairly significant stroke. So these things, sometimes they can pass, but often they don't and get patients into trouble and they really should be seen. It's actually a blessing to have a warning sign You know, that 15% that Jane mentioned, that's actually a blessing that you should go get treated before you have a major problem.
Jane?
I would like to say that one of the reasons I think people who have strokes decide to go lie down, take a nap, see if it goes away, is that the organ that is supposed to be your thinking thing that tells you something to do that's rational is the organ that's being affected by the stroke. So there's a huge amount of people not really understanding the severity of their deficits. Some people don't even recognize they're having deficits, and it's up to an observer. And something I think is an important public message to get out is that if you find someone who is having difficulties that look like they might be having a stroke, so that's usually something their brain is not working right acutely, like they suddenly have a change in their brain that's not doing the things it's supposed to be doing, you want to call 911, but you also want to find out best you can, when were they last normal? That has a lot of impact on our treatments for the blood clot busting medication. So we need to know not just when you found them with their symptoms, but when were they last in their normal state with their brain acting in its normal way.
So frankly, if you're having a stroke, that stroke is dumbing you down and it's making you maybe not think rationally. And so if your loved one says, I'm going to get you to the hospital, you may say, oh, no, I'm fine. But you're not really responding. The person responding and saying I'm fine is not the intelligent person you usually are.
That's exactly right.
Dr. Ecker.
Yeah, there's a beautiful TED talk by a Harvard professor, and she describes, actually, she had a hemorrhagic stroke, so actually a bleed in the brain. But she describes actually a period of euphoria, and the euphoria leading to this total disorientation. And she is actually a neuroscientist, so she knew something was wrong with the brain. But actually, as she was having the hemorrhage, there was this period not of pain, not of perceived disability, but actually of euphoria. So when the brain's not working right, the ability to make those rational decisions, like Jane said, it's not there.
And let me ask you about something you said just a couple minutes ago, Dr. Ecker. You said you had a patient who'd been shaking out his hand for 3 days. A lot of us get, tingling in our fingers or toes, and we think, oh, our hand fell asleep, I think is the expression. What's the difference between a usual tingling in your fingers and toes and something to be concerned about?
I think really loss of function is the issue. This person was trying to shake out a hand that wasn't working at all, and somehow came back online and wasn't working at all. And loss of function is the biggest deal. So if you've got something that was working and isn't working now, I think that's really a moment where you really need to get help.
Okay. We'll go to Stephen calling from Winslow. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I've got a question. Back in 2017, I had a stroke, and within a month, I was diagnosed with Lyme, which I'd been sick for a little while. And recently, I heard someone explain the same story to me while I was having blood drawn at a lab. And I'm just wondering, what do you think of that?
Yeah, Stephen, thank you for that question. Just so you know, Monday, June 1st, our main calling show is on ticks and Lyme disease. Dr. Morris, do we know if there's a connection between Lyme disease and stroke?
There is. It's hard to say in Stephen's case. I mean, there's a lot of Lyme in Maine, and there are a lot of strokes. The direct link of Lyme vasculitis and stroke is an extremely rare. It's on that list of very rare causes of stroke. And to diagnose it, we typically will see abnormalities in the vessel that suggest that the vessels are infected, and then you have to do a lumbar puncture and look at titers of your Lyme in your spinal fluid versus the Lyme in the blood. Not something we routinely do for a stroke workup. And certainly not a common cause of stroke. It would be considered a very rare link.
All right, Stephen, thank you. An email here from Tamar. My brother recently died from a basal stroke. My sister-in-law was also told he only had one blood vessel, where most people have three. I didn't want to ask her for details. Do you know what was being referred to, and could you explain this anomaly in more detail? How common is this, and can it be hereditary, and would it be possible to have screening for some of these risks? I'll turn to you, Dr. Ecker.
There's a lot of complexity in what you just described. So without having taken care of the patient, having seen the angiogram and the pictures, I can't guide it, but I can give some really broad overviews. When you speak about basilar, there is a critical artery in front of the brainstem called the basilar artery. It is an area where we see strokes. It is a severe kind of stroke. So untreated, a basilar artery occlusion has an 80% mortality. So it is a terrible cause of stroke, and it's something that needs to be emergently treated. If it goes too long and the brainstem itself dies, which is the end organ in this case, it tends to be something that's not retrievable or leads to a kind of stroke that many wouldn't want to live with. As far as having 1, 2, 3, in the kind of quote unquote normal brain, there are 4 blood vessels that feed the brain, both carotid arteries in front. Most people are aware of those. They're in the neck. There are 2 arteries that go through the spine, the side of the spine, and then to the base of the brain called the vertebral arteries that combine to form this basilar artery in front of the brain. Most of us are born with all 4 and all 4 working. Over time, from a dissection, from atherosclerotic plaque in it, patients can lose 1, 2. I've even had patients lose 3 blood vessels where literally the whole brain, a little bit like a farm field that's got irrigation pipes coming in, one pipe's feeding the whole field. So a patient's literally living on 1 blood vessel. But I mean, can you have someone who was born with just 1? I'm not sure I've seen that patient. I've seen patients missing a carotid, so they're naturally just have 1 carotid, so-called aplasia of that carotid. But without knowing the specifics, like I say, and being that patient's position, tough to tell.
We'll go to Joni calling from Biddeford. Hi, Joni. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay, I had a stroke back in November. You guys keep saying high blood pressure. I have drug-resistant high blood pressure, and I'm not sure where to go anymore. Even when I go to the emergency room and have an IV and they put drugs in, my heart races and my blood pressure shoots up, and I'm just kind of at a loss of where to turn. Every drug that I've taken has made me ill, and now I'm at the point of, where do I go? Who do I
Joni,
turn to?
I'm so sorry to hear your story. Jane, what is your advice for Joni?
So, Joni, that does sound very difficult. And I really want to steer away from giving medical advice to people who are not directly under my care and who I don't really know the full history, what your intolerances are, were to drugs, what drugs were tried. I have to say you'd want to try to see a blood pressure specialist if you haven't already. Either a cardiologist or a nephrologist, a kidney doctor sometimes, or blood pressure specialist, before you have given up on all treatments.
Joni, good luck to you. Let's see. I'm going to go to Tony calling from York. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a general neurologist in the community and see a lot of people in follow-up for their strokes. And sometimes I think it was mentioned earlier, they go into the emergency room, they're examined. They only have sensory symptoms, or a lot of times their function has returned, and they're sort of dismissed. And I think that those people, whenever I see them, I do a follow-up MRI, which wasn't done, and I say, I always validate them. Even if I don't find anything on the MRI, I says, you're not an expert. Go to the emergency room. That's where the expertise is. And I think the other thing is we have to be constantly vigilant about our outreach. You know, there's big campaigns, but the campaigns have to be constant to remind people through our community and through our community networks to just remind people about recognizing the signs and, getting care.
All right. That's a good thank you, Tony, and a good prompt. We just have a couple of minutes left in the program. Jane, can you remind us what are the most important symptoms to recognize when you are around someone who is not acting like themselves?
Yeah. So Dr. Goswami brought up this acronym, which is very handy. It's called BFAST. B is balance. BE is eyes. So if you're a sudden loss of vision or double vision. F is for face, a facial droop on one side. A is for arm, that's an arm drift or weakness of one arm. The S is for speech, so slurred speech or incomprehensible speech or not understanding speech. And T is time to call 911. What I tell people is, so strokes tend to come on suddenly, often out of nowhere. The change is abrupt and it's impairing one of the functions of the brain.
And Dr. Ecker, I'm guessing in the few seconds left, what you would like to add is do not stall. Do not hesitate.
Yeah, absolutely. One should get to the emergency room as quickly as possible. And like we said, ideally that's with an EMT. If the only way to get there in Maine is to get to a space where an EMT can get to you, that also works. But really get to the hospital as soon as possible.
Tony, thank you for your call. And thank you to both of our guests today for being with us. Dr. Robert Ecker, a neurological surgery provider with Maine Health, and Dr. Jane Morris, a neurohospitalist and stroke specialist with Maine Health. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy, and our theme song was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Every Friday afternoon, we send out a newsletter. You can be among the first to know what's coming up next week on Maine Calling. You subscribe to that for free at mainecalling.org. Again, mainecalling.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.